our initial guest on the program here tonight. We've been trying to get him on for a while as far as finding the right date for him. And I am very grateful that it ended up working out to be the case. Dave Meltzer and the Wrestling Observer Newsletter, again, that's what started it all back in the 80s. It was, really way back when all you had out there, really, for the most part, was the kayfabe mags. I mean, you had guys like me buying the After mags and going through and buying those things, but there was something else going on aside from the After mags, and it for folks like me in 1990 in reading the National came to find out that there was this whole other scene that was being covered behind the scenes. So it's a real pleasure to get this gentleman on the program tonight. As I indicated, a top authority, probably the top authority here as far as it goes with MMA and professional wrestling journalism. Certainly, there are a lot of huge headlines going on right now. UFC purchasing Strikeforce, the whole Jeff Hardy scandal in TNA, WrestleMania season being what it is. But, again, Steve Cervello, our senior producer, had the idea, if possible, to try to get this gentleman on tonight, and it did work out that way. We wanted to lead with him and get his thoughts as a journalist who has covered the worlds of sports and worked sports in Japan. We're going to start from that slice of life here with all the horrific tragedies in recent days here that we have covered in that country here at the outset, get his thoughts, his observations on Japanese society before we discuss the topics that you would generally expect us to bring up with him. The nicest thing that I can say about this guy is that if you're a pro wrestling fan, you're used to being made to feel stupid by things that happen on TV. You're used to the stereotype being perpetuated. But if you think back to the aftermath of the tragedy that Chris Benoit inflicted on his family, every time this guy was on TV, you didn't feel that way. You always felt like, hey, this is a guy rooted in perspective. He'll tell you the good. He'll tell you the bad. It's not sensationalistic. It's really anything but the whole carny type stuff that the pro wrestling industry generally gives you. And I appreciate that kind of perspective, as does everyone who reads him. We've had on his colleagues on the program previously, Alex Marvez, on two occasions. I think we primarily talked NFL with him at the time. But I think we talked a little bit of pro wrestling and MMA. I know we had on Brian Alvarez and talked a lot of pro wrestling and MMA with him a couple months ago, but it's an indescribable pleasure and privilege to be able to do so with the man himself, Dave Meltzer, editor of the Wrestling Observer Newsletter. Dave, welcome to the FDH Lounge, sir. Good to have you on tonight. How are you?
Yeah, very good, guy. Thanks for that build-up. I'm I'm humbled.
Hey, well, thank you. It's we're pleased to have you in, and I just, as I say, wanted to take a look at Japan here at the outset with you. Just get your perspectives as somebody who has covered a part of the country for the course of the last couple of decades here, since you've been so immersed in pro wrestling and in MMA. And when you look at the really horrific things that have happened here, I mean, the All Japan term of Triple Crown almost kind of comes to mind, but you've got earthquake, tsunami, nuclear meltdown. Never seen this trilogy before. God willing, we never will again. You immediately start to compare that to 9/11 in our country and how a society deals with that kind of a jolt. Theirs is a society that we know is built so much on order and on discipline and on just kind of plowing through regardless. So I just wonder, as far as a gut instinct, and I guess I'm just looking for a gut instinct with you on a couple of these questions, just do you think that they might be better conditioned to be able to get through something like this because that's their mindset? Or in a way, might it be more destabilizing because maybe you come to think you can handle just about anything and then the unthinkable happens?
I think that they could probably handle it better because as a culture, they're really used to working for a cause and being selfless in a lot of ways. And it just is something else that they have to work through. I think that maybe some of that came from, you know, the nuclear bombs and everything like that. And, I mean, it was a generation ago, but everyone in Japan knows those stories. And as bad as this is, it's not as bad as that was. So they've actually, like when we had 9/11, that was one of the, that was the worst thing in our lifetimes and probably the previous generation, perhaps. But for them, this is, you know, they've been through worse than this. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I've talked to several people in Japan, and, you know, since this happened, and they're not, you know, they're not as phased as you would think. I mean, they're phased for sure. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and I think a lot of it also is it's not all of Japan as much as, you know, the certain parts of Japan. I know that when you get to the southern part of Japan, it's, you know, there really wasn't much damage done and everything's business as usual in a sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, not completely, obviously, but it's not as bad as, and that's the thing that they said, it's not as bad as the media is making it out to be. If you get in the southern part of Japan, in the northeast of Japan, it's absolutely horrible.
Yeah. Yeah, it's unbelievable, and now we're hearing that some radiation might be trickling down to Tokyo. They're keeping a close watch yeah. on that. And this is very interesting, Dave, because, again, for most of us that don't either have family over there or business ties or whatever, a lot of people in the country, I think, are like myself and find a lot of the things about that culture kind of mysterious and different. So it's interesting to hear, you know, from somebody who is familiar with it. One of the things that I've read in recent days that I didn't know about previously with this whole Ring of Fire business was that really these tremors and maybe bigger than that, some of the tremors are a part of daily life, at least in some parts of the country. Is that anything where, have you ever been over there and had anything hit like that when you've been there? And have you, what's your sense of people's reaction to these lower level quakes?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I've been there probably, you know, a dozen times, and I never felt an earthquake there. I felt many, many earthquakes here in California.
Mm-hmm.
My impression is, you know, like from people who live in Tokyo, is that, yeah, you know, earthquakes, you know, those kind of earthquakes. But, you know, it's the same thing living here, really, if you live in California. A regular earthquake, you know, they happen from time to time, and they're really not that big of a deal except for, I mean, like in my lifetime, I've been through, I couldn't tell you how many earthquakes, but the only one that was significant was the one in 1989. That mm-hmm. was a big deal, you know, the one during the World Series. But the other ones, I mean, you hear about it, and people will call you up, oh, my God, what happened to the earthquake? And it shook. I was, you know, no, it's really not. Like a huge earthquake, if you get past, like, say, close to the, I guess, the 6.57 level, that's pretty bad. Anything under that, you know, a 5 earthquake or a 6, you know, 5.5 earthquake, that's really nothing. You know, they had a 9, I couldn't even imagine what a 9 is like, having felt a 7. I mean, that's, you know, because each one that you go up is really magnified by 5.5 times. So the earthquake in 89 that people in the United States will remember that stopped the World Series, the earthquake that they had must have been, you know, 27 times, if I have my multiples are right, 27 times as strong. And I couldn't even fathom how that would be. I, you know, it was one of the biggest earthquakes in the history of, you know, records.
Yeah. Yeah, it, some of these things, the wrath of nature, as it were, are just almost unfathomable. In terms of how Japanese society functions, and this starts to tie it somewhat into the world of wrestling and more familiar subjects that we might discuss here tonight. I don't know, my sense, and again, as I'm somebody who's just read a little bit about Japan, but really doesn't feel like he knows very much about it, perhaps I've read Ring of Hell one too many times here, but I can't help but think that when it comes to something like relief supplies here, do you get the sense that keeping the fingers of the Yakuza out of the relief efforts here is going to be something that they're going to need to keep an eye on, or do you feel like something like that might be taboo even to the crime syndicates given the level of devastation that's happened?
They're involved in every level of society there. So, I mean, it's, you know, that's just how it is, and it's not thought of there the same way it's thought of here.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's just they're involved in every level of business, and they'll be involved in this business too.
Yeah, well, that yeah. That doesn't surprise me. As I say, based on what I had read about this, what's your sense as we start to move a little bit more into wrestling and these realms here? The wrestling business over in Japan, which has really been kind of uneven for a while now, especially when you go back to what were the glory days of All Japan and New Japan, and when things were really booming. What do you think something like this does? And you've correctly pointed out here that this is sporadically involving the country. You get to some aspects of the country, it's not as involved. You start to get to Tokyo and points further northeast, and it's really it's consumed by all of the tragedy here. Have you gotten any kind of a sense yet of what this might do with the business short term and medium term? How much of a bump they might take?
A short term, everyone's taking a bump because, you know, a lot of shows have been canceled just because, like the Cork and Hall, which is the kind of like the home base of pro wrestling in Tokyo. It's a small building. It had some structural damage, so right now no one can run it. So a lot of shows, you know, a lot of those shows have been canceled. Everything, obviously, in the Northeast has been canceled. So this tour that the current tour that everyone's going through is going to hurt. And these are hand to mouth organizations, you know. So missing dates, it's going to hurt a lot when they get through it. I think that the long term will be negligible, if anything. Once the Northeast repairs, like New Japan did a show on Sunday, I believe it was, but they did a show which was kind of a mid-level show. I mean, it wasn't a small show, but it wasn't a big show either. And they had to sell out and turn people away, but it wasn't near the Earthquake Center. So people are willing to go to wrestling. You know, I mean, there's, you know, this coming weekend, there's actually several big shows in Japan this coming weekend that are going on as planned. I don't know how they're, you know, all going to draw. I mean, one of them's in, you know, the All Japan shows in Tokyo at Sumo Hall. So, but yeah, I think that, like, again, it's like, how did 9/11 affect the pro wrestling business in the United States? You know, it really didn't at all. Mm-hmm. Some people say, you know, I mean, like, our business went down, but I think that was because of the business. I don't think it was because of 9/11. I think, you know, their business is going to be about where it was, you know, starting, you know, maybe a month from now, you know, but short term, yeah, it's devastating.
Is there the sense, again, for a country that prizes order as much as they do, that going back to these shows might be seen culturally as a way of sort of pressing on, you know, through everything that has happened here, and that it might be regarded as kind of a healing balm to go out and kind of live life as one normally would have, at least for one night?
I think so. I think there's something to that, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I remember wrestling was a big part of the healing of the country after World War II. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where the cultural strength of professional wrestling there is, you know, built around, you know, the Japanese society and Riki Dozan beating the big Americans. And it really, you know, it was very unique how that industry developed there. It's very different from everywhere else. And, you know, in the industry in Japan at its peak, you know, where we're talking about in the 50s and even into the 90s, was for the most part much bigger than it ever was in this country, with possibly the exception of that 1997 to 2001 period where wrestling really was big. But, you know, when I was over there, it was just, you know, when you're just around it, it was so much bigger than in the United States. I would tell people, like, you know, they go, oh, yeah, you know, like Antonio Inoki's like Hulk Hogan. I go, no, he's like Muhammad Ali. It's a different level than Hulk Hogan. But, you know, people just kind of see, like, Hulk Hogan being the ultimate, or, oh, it's like WWE, and it's like, no. It's like in real society, like, you know, you walk down the street and you see billboards with wrestlers on them, you know, everywhere you go. I mean, not now, but mm-hmm. I'm talking about in its glory days.
The presentation of it over there, I always get a chuckle when I think about this. There was that great line for The Simpsons. Homer was explaining it to his daughter. He said, "It's real over there, Lisa." You know, so that's just that's the image that people tend to have as far as how seriously the Japanese take it. Segueing a little bit here to you talked about 97 to 01, the boom period in America when a certain individual first rose to a level of great prominence, mostly as a member of a tag team, the latter part of that, doing a little bit of singles here. Jeff Hardy, arguably the nadir of his career the other night, at least I hope it was. I hope there's no place to go further down after what we saw the other night. Your colleague, Brian Alvarez, with a scathing takedown of not only Jeff Hardy, but TNA, the entire thing here. It is hard to feel sorry for anybody involved in this whole situation, Dave. Again, it's been documented, all the warning signs with him and everything, even down to not showing up fit to compete a couple months ago. I guess it was back in December or whenever, and still they kept the belt on him at the time. They just kind of dug their heels in, regarded it as an act of defiance, us against the world. You really set yourself up for something like this, and as sad as it is, I'm sure we can all picture Vince Russo sitting in a bunker right now scheming a way to make a worked shoot out of this.
Yeah. Well, maybe there's part of this, and that maybe there's a part of them that's happy that it's got all this attention, because, you know, there is that mentality with Russo and with Bischoff. But, yeah, I mean, again, It is hard to feel sorry because all the warning signs have been there. The warning signs were there before they hired him. It was a risk to hire him. It was a hell of a risk to put the world title on him, but they did. I mean, he wasn't champion at the time, but, I mean, this easily could have happened when he was champion, and he was in a pay-per-view main event. The thing that I can't wrap around is okay, this happened, but how did that main event happen? I mean, they could have just, you know, the last time that this happened, they went in there and they, you know, they were about to change the whole card, and I don't know why, instead of doing a one-minute match, they didn't change the whole card, or if they were going to do the one-minute match just to say, okay, we gave it, to send, you know, Van Damme or Anderson or both out and do a three-way, and at least people will get a main event. And the fact they didn't do that is just, that's a creative decision, and the only thing I could come up with is that they felt that they would get more talk by having that thing, because everyone would talk about it, but if they ended the card with like a normal wrestling match, people wouldn't talk about it. So I think that to an extent, they are encouraging this. They think it's good for the company.
Oh, the whole thing of there is no such thing as bad publicity. I mean, it's got people talking, but it's got people talking just reinforcing the notion that they're a laughing stock, which has been the case for a couple of years now as far as how people viewed them, really off and on since the beginning of the company. It's a thing here where maybe this is the missing link to understanding the whole thing here, Dave. I don't know the degree to which this has been substantiated one way or another. The degree to which Sting freelanced out there during the match, do you get the sense the creative people had a sense in back that Jeff Hardy, although out of it, could at least go for a couple of minutes? If you watch the tape, and we all have by now, much as the people have the Zapruder film dissecting it, it does seem as though Sting freelanced a little bit as far as the length of the match and just saying, screw this, I'm not going to put myself at risk from a guy who's drug-addled here. Do you get the sense that impression's correct?
I don't see Sting making that call. I see that may have been what Bischoff said to him before he went out and did it, or it appeared, again, I don't know how much of this is a work shoot. It appeared to me that, you know, Hardy didn't know, you know, what was going on, but he didn't overreact either. He didn't throw a fit. You know, it's just a very weird deal. A lot of unanswered questions. I think that that's what they wanted out of this. But Sting, I don't see Sting as a guy who would, you know, make that call on a split second notice. And the fact is, the referee didn't hold up his count, which is another thing. So the referee had to be in on it. You know, the referee had to know what he was doing. If not, the referee would count 1-2 and then stop. And then, you know, if the guy, he'd do that hesitation three where the referee, all of a sudden the light went on. Oh my God, this is something happened here. But he didn't do that. So the ref knew what was going on. It wasn't Sting making the call.
Well, that's a very interesting point. And again, it's kind of sad that it takes something like this to get TNA on the radar whatsoever when it's WrestleMania season. I guess they're thinking we'll take what we can get as far as attention right now. It's easy to think that aside from something like this, they would just be completely under the radar for the next month or so, at least. Of all the things that people are talking about with everything happening, both last night and the continued build-up to WrestleMania here, I have to say, one of the things I was more curious to talk to you about is something I haven't read a whole lot in terms of opinion and reaction. That extraordinary segment last night that ended with JR in the ring and Waller, and they were getting it handed to them, but started with Brian Christopher and Jerry Lawler with that, I don't know if we call it a work shoot or whatever the heck that was. How does something like that happen? The WWE is notorious sometimes for using storylines to embarrass people. I can't see that being done unwillingly to Jerry Lawler. He's been a good sport throughout time about what gets used in storylines. So how did something like that materialize?
I think it's just creative's idea. Lawler may very well have been, you know, he had to have gone for it, because if he didn't want to do it, he wouldn't have done it. So, I mean, I don't know where they're thinking of, you know, Brian Christopher out of nowhere. I'm thinking that he, you know, may have suggested it himself. I don't know that, but I don't get the impression that he had any trouble with it. It ended up being a pretty good segment. Not so much Brian Christopher, but after Brian Christopher, I thought it was a really good segment. Brian Christopher, he just looked so bad.
He did. He did. And really, and but the part where Jerry Lawler was burying him back, that was a thing where, and I think it was in Todd Martin's Raw report, I think that's where I read this take and I agreed with it. Kind of an odd thing for a face to do, because it's been pretty well established here, not least of which by Jerry Lawler in his own book, that he wasn't Ward Cleaver. So to go out there, and if you know the real story, that he wasn't a picture-perfect dad, for him to try to turn around the sympathy by burying his kid did seem an odd way to go with it.
Yeah, it did. Except, you know, I think one of the things, like, I kind of know, you know, and followed Brian for so long, so and kind of have a feel. I don't really have a good feel for their relationship, but a little bit of one. But you know, it made sense to me. I don't know that it made sense to the viewer at home, and that, so, you know, so in that sense, yeah. Yeah, there's something there. But at the end of the day, because of the whole thing with JR, I don't know that that's what people, you know, what was the closing thought. And I think maybe JR was there to be kind of like, when he backs Lawler, that kind of like is, okay, I guess that Lawler really wasn't the bad guy here. So maybe that Jim Ross being involved in the thing was to make sure that everyone knew when all was said and done, that, you know, this was a low blow by Michael Cole as opposed to Jerry Lawler, you know, taking the low road against his son.
Interesting point. Yeah, that, you're probably right about that as far as the positioning and how they wanted people to see it. What's your overall sense of the build going into it this year? I know that I have thought that, as opposed to the last 2 years when they seem to start their world title storylines at the Elimination Chamber, they've clearly had a longer build this year. The Del Rio Edge thing started right after the Royal Rumble. You could kind of see Miz and Cena coming for a while now. Between that and the celebrities that they're working in, not least of which the successful wrestlers of the past, Steve Austin and The Rock, it would seem to me like they got to be poised for a bigger buy rate than the disappointments of the last 2 years. What's your overall sense of it, Dave?
Well, they got to beat last year, and last year was a disappointment. 2 years ago, they did much better than I expected. I think that they'll beat 2 years ago. But to me, I mean, I would have said, if you take The Rock out of this storyline, the only thing that they would have on this show that was all that strong is Lawler Michael Cole. I think that the rest of the show is not particularly strong, not close to as strong as even last year. Undertaker and Triple H is nowhere in the ballpark of Undertaker and Shawn last year. I don't think the title match, you know, Cena and Miz is not as big to me as Cena and Batista was last year. But throwing in The Rock, it's much bigger. Rock is the difference. To me, Rock is a difference maker, but I think it's going to be I think it's going to do real well.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I sense it'll be the biggest in 3 years. I don't know that it'll beat it might beat the Mayweather numbers. I don't think it'll beat the Trump numbers from 4 years ago. I don't know. But I could see it beating the Mayweather number, only because wrestling is all of a sudden gotten pretty hot. But the Mayweather number, I mean, it wasn't so much Mayweather, but the Flair retirement really was a big deal. I don't, for whatever reason, it was a much bigger deal than the Shawn retirement.
Well, in terms of Cena Batista versus Cena and The Miz, I think you're absolutely right about that, because we had years of conditioning to see Batista as a main event guy. Whatever his failings were, whether or not he lived up to it, and he certainly never lived up to the initial build as a main eventer in 2005 due to you know, varying things, injuries, move set, etc. Having said that, though, do you put a lot of stock? I mean, I'm seeing a lot of my fellow smart marks out there right now really kind of talking about this whole thing with Miz, that this is a star-making program for him. That, yeah, he's not as big as Batista right now, but based on this thing and the way that he's been built, particularly in the last 2 weeks and maybe even a little bit further back than that, that he's being set up to be a serious, serious player in the future. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think they've been setting him up for that role for months. I think he's done very well. And ever since he won the title and he got all that publicity, I think that the company was really behind him. I think he's done a really good job, but there is clearly something missing, and it's still missing now. Whether that will, you know, whether that thing won't be missing in a couple months, I don't know. And I mean, every week I look at it and go, you know, is it still missing? And then, I mean, like the ratings, like from last night, I mean, when he was on, I mean, in an overrun, they went down. I had never heard of an overrun losing viewers, and it lost viewers last night. And, I mean, it wasn't just him. I mean, it was Cena and Del Rio, too. And Cena's a big, you know, ratings draw, generally speaking. But whatever it is, the Miz's segments, the people do not react to the Miz's segments like a world champion yet. Will they? Should they? You know, you can speculate as people don't believe he's a tough guy. There's a lot of different things. I know my gut. Whenever I watch him, you know, and this is just my gut on him, and it's but whatever reason is, I can accept him as a mid-card guy, but as a world champion, he's missing an innate toughness. And it's so funny because I don't think anyone thinks of wrestlers as necessarily being tough anymore compared to, like, in the old days where, you know, you really had to be – people in their minds, if they didn't believe you were tough, you weren't going to be a main eventer. And now, in theory, you know, I don't know that – people see wrestlers as necessarily being super tough guys. They're more entertainers. But for whatever reason, there's something that's missing in Miz, and it's obviously not the promo ability, and his work is okay, even good. I mean, he's not the greatest worker in the business, but he's not an embarrassment, and he's fine for his role. But whatever, and works hard, a very hard worker. But there is, whatever it is, there's something missing in the Miz, and I don't know exactly what it is, but it's there.
Exactly. And there's a real attachment to the company, to the whole archetype of the cowardly heel. And the way that he was booked in the beginning end of his title reign really kind of fit into that. Maybe they did a little bit of damage there.
Maybe that role might be great for a mid-card heel, but that role is not great for a new world champion. It might be great for a... what's the word I'm looking for? An established world champion with years of being on top, maybe. But when you're in your first run on top... and you're in the cowardly role, maybe that's part of the problem. I don't really know. I've had a lot of people suggest what the problem is. I have my theories, but all I know is that there is something that they have to work through, and they may. I mean, because promo-wise, he feels like, you know, for months now, when I watch him, he feels like a guy who, in my mind, if he had a little bit more toughness to him, would be, you know, really the, you know, a really key guy for, you know, who's going to be like a 5-year, you know, run as a top guy, as opposed to just one of these guys who, you know, is kind of a trivia note historically. I mean, I think he could be like a real deal, but it's not there yet.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting to get your thoughts on this here, because it presents a side to this that I hadn't really considered, and I think probably a lot of other people as well. Somebody who never had to deal with being booked as a cowardly heel champion for a multitude of reasons, Triple H, back when he first got established here. When this program started with The Undertaker, there were thoughts that it was going to be similar to last year, possibly Triple H's career on the line. This now is not the case, so I'm wondering where this goes after WrestleMania. There had been the sense, particularly as much as he's enjoyed his new role over the last year working behind the scenes, that perhaps we are going to be seeing more Paul Levesque in the future than Triple H. Is it too early to get a sense on whether that'll be the case or not, or do you think he's going to come back for good at this point?
I don't think he's going to come back for good ever again. I think he may be in the Shane McMahon role, in the sense that he'll come in for programs every now and then.
Okay.
But I think as a full-time wrestler, he's pretty much done. I think he'll be for WrestleMania. He'll probably do a program for SummerSlam. But as far as going on the road and wrestling, I don't see that. I don't see him doing that anymore. And Undertaker the same. You know, Undertaker probably has limited number of matches left. I think that the key that they have is to get him through this match and make sure that he's available for next year's WrestleMania. You know, maybe a SummerSlam or something. But you know, they got to be very careful with him, because he's, you know, his shoulder is just a mess. And he's got all kinds of injuries, but the shoulder one may be the career-ending one.
Absolutely. Yeah, they want to get that 20th WrestleMania match in the books, no question about that. So our final segue here tonight, The Undertaker, of course, a noted fan of MMA, and a lot of MMA fans this weekend, I think, were probably ecstatic with the sense here with the merger, the takeover by UFC and the Zuffas with Strikeforce. Is it the sense, I mean, this is the real obvious surface kind of take on this, Dave, that it's great for the fans, they get to see the dream matchup, not so much for the boys in the back, trademark Vince Russo, because now it's like pro wrestling circa 2001, where they have no leverage. Is that surface take the correct one?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, for the fans, I don't know if it's going to be good or bad. I mean, like, when the WCW thing went down, I thought it was going to be great. I thought it was going to be the beginning of not a long-term boom. And again, short-term, it did do some business. But I expected there'd be a one-year run where business would be through the roof, maybe not even a year. And then things would go down because, you know, they would just go down. And we didn't get 1 year. We got realistically from maybe July. That July pay-per-view was real big. But I mean, certainly by the November pay-per-view, it was already, you know, the bloom was way off the rose. That's why they ended it. So, I mean, they only got a couple, you know, I mean, the WCW-WF thing, you know, was one of the worst. But that's completely inapplicable because the fact is that these results are real. So it can't be blamed on an organization. But as far as, like, long-term, if this is going to be good or bad for the fans, I don't know. Is it going to be good or bad? You know, there's so many unanswered questions. I think short-term we're going to get a lot more interesting matchups if they can get these new people over. I'm as a fan, I think that I'm kind of intrigued by it, but there's a sense of sadness to me too because I like competition, and I think the competition is really good for the sport, and I think it's really good for the fighters. For the fighters, it's, you know, fighters I've talked to, you know, I mean, mostly not happy. You know, I can't say everyone, but mostly not happy.
Well, in terms of the aspect of it with the fights that can be built at this point, the dream matches that are left. I mean, your point is very well taken about how in 2001 the ball was dropped. And again, and I have long thought that might have been the worst missed opportunity in the history of pro wrestling, what they did there. By the same token, you had other folks who had these outside deals that were still remnants of the WCW thing, and Vince McMahon, in his infinite wisdom, didn't choose to go get them. Ric Flair, before the invasion was done, Scott Steiner, and Nash Hall, Hogan, he subsequently got them, didn't bring them in when it counted. There's not much of a comparison to this situation, is there? Because it seems like just about everybody they would want, they do have, including, I think, even Fedor at this point, correct?
Yeah. It's not going to be like that. And plus, the other thing is that, you know, what killed that was there was a mentality in WWF that we can't put these other guys over us because we've spent all this time building our brand and we can't make it look like these outsiders were as good as we were, which was, you know, so they were basically a self-defeating philosophy. In this one, I mean, if Dana White's mentality is that, you know, if Alistair Overeem beats Cain Velasquez, oh my God, it proves that their guys were actually better than our guys. You know, it's like when they go in the thing, he can't book it. I mean, whoever's going to win is going to win. So it's like, you know, so that they can't screw it up as bad as WWF, nor would they. But they couldn't even if they wanted to, because nature will take its course and it's going to go how it's going to go. I mean, it may end up screwed up because of how nature takes its course. That's what I'm saying. It's like there's so many variables that are out of everyone's control on this one. So many moving parts. I just, you know, I can't say it's going to be good or bad or what it's going to be. I mean, you've got, you know, different contracts and a lot of different guys and what matches are going to be made and how the public's going to view things. And I mean, you know, the potential's there, and I don't know that from the structure of a sport, maybe it is really good that you have one giant organization as long as it's solvent and healthy, because these, you know, fly-by-night organizations in a lot of ways hurt the sport more than help it anyway. And hopefully these guys, you know, I mean, they've done a great, great job of building the sport and of making money with the sport. And, you know, the Strikeforce fighters are now on the team. So, you know, not a team looking to sell. So, you know, there's that plus. But there's, you know, there's all the minuses as well of running too many shows and just a lot of things, trying to promote too much at the same time, and it all gets in the way.
Well, it's going to be really uncharted territory, seeing how it plays out. I know Dana White made the kind of famous comparison at the time of the takeover of Pride, that it would be like the AFL-NFL merger. It didn't live up to it then. A couple of years down the pike, maybe it does this time, Dave, as far as having more guys under the same umbrella. I admit, I thought at the time, too, I'm not a huge follower of MMA. I watch it kind of casually. I thought at the time he'd be able to make all the dream matchups happen, but maybe the second time, so to speak, is the charm.
Yeah, well, I mean, here's the one thing. they've been in the situation to learn from their mistakes. Although, you know, in a sense with Pride, it was, you know, I don't know that they made mistakes. It was just certain things that happened, the inability to get television in Japan being the key one, that just necessitated what happened. Like, people will go, you know, they botched it. I don't know where they botched it. And the fighters, you know, it was like, you know, Mirko Krokop couldn't win, you know? I mean, if like that was a big thing. If Mirko Krokop could win his fights, maybe it would be different. But you know, again, like, they have a television deal in place, so that already makes it more successful than the Pride thing. You know, the whole key to this business is television. And when they couldn't get TV in Japan, you know, the Pride, you know, they couldn't run a Pride show. It would have been suicide, you know. So they did the right thing there.
Yeah, and, you know, this time around, as you say, some of the circumstances are a little bit different, and I think we'll all be intrigued to see how that plays out. Dave, we always love to give our guests a chance to plug anything and everything here. I know that The Observer these days is pretty much multi-platform. You've got between print and the web. Now you've got your audio updates as well here. I know there's many different manifestations by which people can get the pro wrestling and MMA content. So anything we didn't cover on that sufficiently, please take it away.
Yeah, well, just you go to www.wrestlingobserver.com, and there's information on how to do everything. You can get a website subscription, which includes the newsletter. It includes audio shows, several a day, and you know, so and all of the articles on the website. So that's like the key thing you can do. You can also get the Observer as a print newsletter mailed to your door. There's details on how to do it on the website as well. So. You know, that's the you know, that's the thing. But yeah, I mean, most people seem to prefer the website subscription these days because there's the value for the dollar is tremendous. I mean, you're getting so much. You're getting literally 14 newsletters a month between old newsletters and new newsletters, and you know, several audio shows per day, and it's only $11 a month. So you know, all the news on MMA, professional wrestling, all over the world.
Amen to that, and it's great to get, as you said, too, immersed in the back issues as well and things that happened previously and kind of relive some of that. Dave, it was a real pleasure to have you on tonight. To use the old analogy here, I was the broomstick, you were 1980s circa Ric Flair, and, you know, it was thank you for carrying us to a five-star conversation tonight, Dave.
Well, thanks for those nice words.
It was a pleasure, Dave. We'd love to have you back on the show. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Dave. Dave Meltzer, everybody. What a pleasure it was to have had him.